You believe Ishtar and think me a curse. But if there is anything I can swear by, it is that I will never break our oath, Father. If that confounds the gods, then so be it. He barely realized that one hand had curled into a shaking, white-knuckled fist. I will show you. A sudden frantic clatter snapped him from his introspection. He swung round just as the two wrestlers in the sunken pit at the heart of the low, dark hall tumbled up onto the floor in a baleful embrace. The larger of the two hauled the smaller up by his loincloth and his club of hair, then hurled him towards the edge of the hall. The fellow flailed through tables and chairs, sending cups of barley beer fountaining in his wake. Hattu ducked back an instant before the fellow went plunging through the window with a strangled yelp. A great roar went up from the spectators, and they exchanged trinkets and copper rings to settle bets. The victorious wrestler stood tall, beaming, his oiled skin glistening, and his smile spoiled by the tooth that had been knocked out during the bout.
Next!
He shouted with extreme confidence, leaping back into the pit. The fellow who had exited hastily moments before made a commendable attempt at climbing back in the window.
Not finished,
he slurred, blood streaming from his broken nose and one eye swollen shut.
I'd say you are,
Hattu suggested, helping him inside, then resting him on his chair, where he passed out at once, snoring. He turned away to find the rest of the mountain wolves. The interior of the Azana house was as big as a paddock, packed with men in military tunics or kilts, hugging the maze of niches and benches or craning over the wooden balcony of the mezzanine, beer cups sloshing as they drank in great, untasting gulps, belching and cheering the next wrestling bout. Bubbles of orange lamplight gave the place the appearance of a cave, and coils of fragrant smoke battled hard against the olfactory assault of stale drink and the rank odour of unwashed men.
Hattu!
Garin called from the darkness of one niche. His fleshy features were ruddier than usual and beaded with sweat.
Are you well?
Hattu asked. Then the harlot sitting behind him in the darkness leaned forward, her sultry dark-lined eyes glued to Hattu as she nibbled on Garin's ear, then wrapped her legs around his waist and drew him back into an embrace.
Dagon has something for you,
he said, before his words grew ecstatically muffled. Hattu cocked an eyebrow and left them to it. A hand with a fresh cup of foaming beer shot out in front of him.
There you are,
Tanku said, pushing the cup into his hand. The big recruit was seated, wearing just a kilt and cradling his newly awarded captain's helm, dark brown leather with a bronze brow band like the others, but with a long dark plume that trailed to the small of his back when wearing it. Behind him, a bald masseur was rubbing oil into Tanku's back and grinding his elbows into the muscles.
We've made it. Summer is over and we're unbroken.
Drink.
You should be enjoying this as much as the rest of us, he insisted.
Hattu drew a mouthful of the bitter drink through the reed straw. Just months ago, he would never have felt such ease alongside the burly soldier. Now he did. Tanku was bold, stubborn, and at times reckless, and all those things had surfaced thanks to Kurunta's brutal training. But underneath, Tanku was a good young man who sought simple pleasures for himself and his close ones.
The women are quite beautiful,
Tanku said, eyes combing the niches where soldiers and harlots cavorted. Then he held up his cup with a grin.
Especially after a few of these.
Hattu smiled, taking another mouthful of beer. The drink was warming his blood already, loosening his stiff neck. He saw a few intent-laden and expertly painted female faces peek out from the dark recesses. He'd never lain with a woman, and for a moment his loins stirred. Yet all he could think of was one girl, far from here.
I'll let Garin and the others enjoy their company. For me, there is someone else, he said.
Tanku's eyebrows arched.
I?
Atea. She lives at the Storm Temple. She is bright and beautiful like the dawn, he said without effort.
Ha! But she's in her Tusa, is she not? You're here now. Some say it is the last rite of a prince to make him a man,
Tanku grinned. When one of the harlots coiled and uncoiled a finger, beckoning him, flashing one up-tipped breast, he felt his throat drain of moisture. The truth was, it seemed more daunting than the leap over the bridge of the mountain god. A slurred voice and stale beer breath ended his quandary.
You don't talk to him,
a hulking soldier growled, pushing in between Tanku and Hattu. He was from the Blaze Division, Hattu realized.
They call him the Cursed Son.
Tanku stood and elbowed the man away.
Then they are fools,
he shouted. The pipe music faded and the wrestling stopped.
Tanku, it doesn't matter, Hattu whispered.
Aye, it does,
Tanku countered.
We are the Mountain Wolves, he cried. Prince Hattu is one of us.
He beat his fist against his chest. From dark corners and tables dotted around the Arzana house, 98 other young men suddenly shot to their feet and emitted the keening wolf howl. Raku Flatface and a handful of other storm men also thumped their cups on their tables in agreement. A tense silence passed. Hattu saw the many other veterans in the place cast chill looks upon his comrades, the kind of looks they had previously reserved for him alone. Soon, though, the pipe struck up again. The raucous chatter continued, and the two wrestlers resumed knocking lumps out of one another.
How do you do it, Tanku? Hattu asked as they both sat again. You have no notion of fear.
He laughed once, then dropped his head a little and began knitting and unknitting his fingers.
One night when I was a boy, I noticed a white, glossy orb on the ceiling above my bed, he said,
the fire in his voice now but an ember.
I was fascinated by it. So sleek, so delicately woven in the finest threads. I went to sleep that night and I woke, hearing a terrible scratching noise, near me, all around me, on me. I opened my eyes and saw the white orb on the ceiling had ruptured like a boil. 3 dozen or more spiders were scurrying across my face, one in my ear, many in my hair. I'd heard tales of venomous spiders and what their bites could do to a boy. My mother was asleep nearby, but I was too afraid to scream, lest they crawled into my mouth. So I lay there for the rest of the night, silent, alone, terrified. I understand fear well enough.
Hattu felt an invisible itch on every part of his skin. He rose, clamping a hand to Tanku's shoulder.
I don't know what lies ahead for us, but whatever it might be, spiders, brigands, Kaskans, you will not be alone.
Tanku planted a hand over Hattu's, looking up.
Well, that's the greatest lesson I've learned during this summer, he said with a smile.
Hattu wandered off, sat on a bench by the wall, and took a long draw on his beer. He felt warm and weightless now. He barely noticed Dagon sitting down by his side. He pressed something into Hattu's hand. Hattu spread his palm. It was a Tear's teardrop beryl stone.
This? How did you know?
Hattu gasped. The last he had seen of this was when he had traded it for 3 loaves of bread months ago.
I bought it back for you. I saw you on those early nights, stroking the stone for comfort. Then I saw you barter it in exchange for food for the rest of us.
Dagon laughed and took a drink of his wine.
Were we worth it?
Hattu tied the stone back in his hair and looked around the smoky haze, the drunken chaos and the many soldiers. 1 face in 10 was friendly now, at least.
Aye. You were, he smiled.
Chapter 10. Sacred Rain. Late winter, 1301 BC. The winter was severe, the days short and perishing. The heartlands were blocked with deep snow, the countryside deserted, every sane person having retreated to the safety and shelter of the Hittite cities. A bitter wind blew into Hattu's eyes as he plunged along the top of the snow-coated fells under an angry sky, his bare chest running with sweat, his now shoulder-length hair and linen kilt wet with it too. It had been a long, lonely winter, with just a few soldiers and Kurunta for company, in the all but deserted fields of bronze. The wolves were gone. Dagon, Tanku, Garin, Kistner, and Sargis had all left in the days following the drunken night in the Arzana house. In the distance, he could see the white-coated mass of Hattusa off to the east.
Damn you, father, he growled,
vaulting over a boulder, a shower of snow spraying in his wake. His skin stung, and his chest burned with every breath as he came to a red outcrop mottled with patches of clinging snow. He launched from the run and onto the lower face, feet and hands latching onto the holds he had spotted from a few strides away. A moment later, he was on his way up. The cold bit at his fingers, but the holds were good, and soon there was nothing in his mind but the climb. He hauled himself onto the top of the rocky tower and sat cross-legged, swiping the sweat from his face and tucking his hair behind his ears. He pulled a woolen cloak from his leather bag around his body. The keening wind picked up for a moment. This, he decided, was probably the definition of alone. Then he heard something else, something familiar, high above. He looked up into the sky, white and bruised with full storm clouds, to see a tiny shadow up there swooping down towards him.
"Arrow!" he gasped.
He shot out his left arm, offering the dark brown bracer to her. She landed on his wrist as if they had never been apart.
"You are far from your nest, girl, and a storm threatens," he reprimanded her, stroking her back with one finger.
Then he heard another shriek. A smaller falcon appeared, a male, swooping down to settle in the snow near Hattu.
"A mate?" he cooed.
Arrow shrieked at him in reply, head tilting one way, then the other.
"Ah, just friends, I see," he said puckishly.
She beat her wings a few times, and Hattu could tell she and her new partner were eager to fly again. So he pulled out a strip of dried pork and fed her a piece, tossing the other part to the male falcon. While they devoured the meal at frightening speed, he took the opportunity to draw from his purse the small animal bracelet he had won in a wrestling bet at the end of that heady evening in the Arzana house, a bet that had resulted in an overconfident Sargis being turned nearly inside out by the champion wrestler. The trinket wasn't a fine piece like the things Muwa often brought to Tia, but it meant just as much.
"Take this to her," he said,
as he tied it to Arrow's leg and flicked his wrist, sending her skywards again, the male bird quickly taking flight in pursuit. He took a mouthful of icy water from his drinking skin, then climbed down from the outcrop and set off at a jog for the edge of the fells. As he descended the slope, the same slope that had nearly bested him the previous summer, he saw the fields of bronze down at the foot, veiled in white. He heard a guttural grunting from down there, and saw a lone figure in the snowy training ground, loping up a small artificial dirt hill. Up, then down, then back up again, over and over, the lone silver braid jostling.
"Now try it with 6 buckets of water," Hattu chuckled.
He had come to admire Kurunta One-Eye, much in the way a runner might appreciate the calluses on his heels and toes. One night, in the depths of winter, while thunder crackled above the academy and a blizzard howled, he had heard the so-called Breaker of Men crooning. Soft, gentle tones. First it was a sonnet of love, of his fondness for his wife. Next he sang a quiet dirge, one that had Hattu rapt.
"Tahunda weeps and the rain pours, his lightning blinds, his thunder roars. Our fallen sing his ageless song, and in our hearts they're never gone."
He smiled at the memory, then set off at a jog for the downhill track that would take him back to the academy. But something wasn't right. Something in the corner of his eye was not still. Something in the frozen, deserted countryside had moved. A grim shiver crept over him as he turned to see a figure loping along a high, snowy track. For just a moment, the horrors of the Kaskan raid came to him like a nightmare. But this was no Kaskan, he realized, nor was it a raider. He fell to his haunches and peered at the stranger. A man, loping, wearing rags, his feet bare, leaving red blotches on the snow behind him. He cupped a hand to his ear and heard the fellow's distant, ragged breaths. This man was no threat, he realized. Within a moment he was up and running towards the poor wretch. The man saw him, gawped at him with wide, bloodshot eyes, then fell to his knees, weeping. The fellow's hair was matted and his chin thick with stubble, his fingernails broken and packed with dirt.
"Who are you?" Hattu asked.
"A fallen man,"
he wailed, sobbing deeply again.
"I've failed my family,
My people.
Hattu crouched by the man, pulling his water skin out and offering it.
Where did you come from?
He asked, looking out across the man's red-tinged footprints in the snow, coming from the northwest. The countryside beyond had been blocked with snowdrifts for months.
From the lands of Pala,
he gasped, after nearly draining the skin.
A land that now lies in ruin. Our cities had no walls. We could not hold them back,
he wept.
They slaughtered everyone. Everyone. And on they went, razing neighbouring Tumana to the ground too. I ran from them. Like a coward. I ran. And I've been running all winter. Through the white wastes, wading through the block valleys. I hid in caves, ate grubs and roots.
Pala, Tumana, Hattu thought of the northwestern vassals, loyal, vital states. Who did this? The man looked up, his eyes wet.
Pitaga,
he wailed.
The Lord of the Mountains has reduced my homeland to ashes. He roves in my lands, waving the head of Prince Sarpa on the end of his spear.
Many in Hattusa looked on with wide eyes as a stable hand from the academy ushered the bleeding stranger up the main way to the Acropolis. They gossiped and whispered of troubles in nearby allied lands, but their curiosity vanished when the first burst of spring rain came just a few days later. The snow was washed away, and the city exploded with song and colour as the Festival of the Earth began, a month of joyous praise to the gods for the coming of the new year. By the eighth day of the downpour, the rains had grown tepid, falling in sheets. The swollen Ambar River was thick with people, children playing, pregnant women waist-deep, mouthing words of worship to the sky. Silvery-haired wise women stood mid-river, pouring droplets of honey into the current, lips moving in muttered incantations as they launched hand-sized prayer boats of kindling. The main way was even more crowded, the silvery cascade of rain drumming and leaping from its flagstones. People lined the broad avenue. Their robes were drenched as they cheered and chanted at dancers weaving down the road in a snaking line. The lead pair of dancers held up a fierce, fanged clay serpent's head with a lolling forked tongue, while those behind carried a patchwork trail of feathered yellow and orange linen. This was the feared Iluyanka, the demon serpent, nemesis of the storm god. Warriors play fought against the serpent as the dancers twisted around them, much to the crowd's delight. Atia clapped and sang as the procession wound past her. Her heart skipped to the rhythm, and she felt wonderfully free of responsibilities and troubles, soaked to her skin and blithe. Women and men bumped into her as they passed, but she didn't care, laughing like they were. Another fellow bumped into her, and she turned her bright grin upon him. Suddenly, she was seized with surprise. The handsome, amber-haired man smiled, his freckled cheeks lifting.
"My apologies, priestess," he said, bowing to her.
Since that first time she had seen him over a year ago, she had been unable to stop meeting his eye, at the market, by the banks of the Ambar, around the outskirts of the Storm Temple. Whatever wares or business brought him to Hattusa, they certainly brought him here often.
"The wagons are ready. For the Topeka pilgrimage?"
he said, looking past her shoulder down to the Storm Temple's gates. Atia looked there too. A collection of ox wagons were lined up. These would see the silver statue of Tahunda taken from the innermost sanctuary of the Storm Temple and towed to the fort city of Topeka, to bring it before the city's high altar, where the supreme god could commune with the sky. Again, she had been overlooked, and would not be part of the temple party that would ride with it. But next year, the elder priestess had told her that morning, she would be included. A shiver of pride ran through her.
"They are," she said. "The silver effigy needs only to be anointed and blessed, and then the journey can begin."
"Hard road, though, is it not?"
the fellow mused.
"The high road is hard but swift, and there is a low road too, lengthy but gentle,"
she answered, echoing what the elder priestess had told her.
"I see,"
the fellow nodded. A man and a woman, drunk and giggling, barged between them. When they passed through, she returned her eyes to the spot the amber-haired man had been. But he was gone. She looked around for a moment, before returning her attentions to the procession, letting out a whoop and clapping. Prince Mua, his thick dark mane drenched and plastered to his face, could not relax. The festival had to be held lest the gods be angered, but much more serious affairs were afoot. He looked beyond the Earth Festival celebrations and uphill. On the noon spur, regiments were already being drilled by the great barracks, readied to form the campaign army. The Kaskan invasion of Pala and Tumana had to be countered. Sarpa's shame had to be ended. Soon they would march, and he would be gone from this place until autumn. He swirled his cup, then took a swig of wine, casting his eye downhill a little, where the play serpent was now approaching the banks of the River Ambar. He saw her there, in the crowds by the stonemason's yard, her headscarf and robe wet through, and locks of soaked hair spiralling across her cheeks. Every time she cheered and laughed, his heart ached. Then he saw her talking with the amber-haired man. A spike of jealousy ran through him, until he laughed it off, and the sadness returned. They were drifting apart, he realized. No, she was drifting away from him, no matter how frantically he paddled to stay with her. During last winter and this, the precious time he had planned to spend with her, she had been distant. Why? I can give you everything. He eyed the tiny vial of petal oils. It wasn't quite as opulent as gifts he had given her before, but it would remind her how much he cared for her, and that was what mattered. He took a last swig from the cup of wine, then clasped the vial in his fist and made his way through the crowds to reach her. He stole up behind her and grabbed her by the waist with a playful rah. She squealed and swung round in his embrace. Mua, she cried, beating a light hand across his chest. You look sweet as honey when you're happy, he said, unable to stop the thought tumbling from his lips. She looked away, embarrassed.
Who could not be joyous on a day like this?
Mua thought of battles past and the struggle for the beset northwestern lands that was to come. Cleaved bodies, screaming men, blood, vultures, a frenzy of flies. He blinked the thoughts away, trying to keep his face bright and his eyes on the serpent procession.
Aye, it is a fine spectacle, is it not?
The Elder Priestess and I wove the tail section, she pointed out proudly. It took us a month, but it was worth it. The textile trader was asking for fortunes to buy a length, so instead we bought flax and—
I'll be leaving soon, Atia, he said, cutting her off.
Her smile fell a little.
I know. She glanced up at the Acropolis. You will look after your father, won't you?
Aye,
Mua replied. His ailments are worsening, but his generals know this. He can still march and ride.
I will miss you,
she said, tilting her head a little. He saw her full lips and the look of expectation on her face. He cupped her hand to her chin and made to kiss her, but she turned her head a little to the side, the kiss landing on her cheek, she kissing his. Rejection again. Another weight pulled at his heart.
Atia, I will miss you terribly.
He gave her the petal oils, but she pushed it back into his palm.
I should not take gifts from you, Mua, she said.
Why not? Do you not see how much I delight in giving you things?
But it's not right, she insisted.
Of course it is.
Why, because there is another, she interrupted. I think I'm in love with someone else.
The words raked his heart. He felt like a fool holding her like this. He let her go, stepping back. He noticed how she had on one wrist a cheap animal trinket, something from the trade wagons that passed the fields of bronze, he reckoned. She was toying with this as she stood there before him in unease.
I'm sorry,
she said, turning to run off into the crowd. Mua's heart ached as if a smith's anvil hung there now.
Mua!
King Marsili called. His shout echoed through the corridors of the palace.
Mua!
He called out again. Silence. Angered and unsure why, Marsili slammed the leather bags down on the hearthroom floor and stuck his head out of the door in search of a palace slave. None were nearby.
Mua!
He started, then fell silent with a stifled croak, clutching a hand to his left armpit. His whole arm stung with invisible needles. He felt his chest tighten, as if an unseen armourer was buckling a willow-thin man's bronze cuirass around his trunk. The pain seemed set to crush him. It was stronger than ever before, but as always, it passed after a few moments.
"My son,"
a voice said, startling him. He swung round to see a horned apparition approaching him. Volker had entered the hearth room via the other door. He stalked across towards the king, silent in his bare feet, the red cloak that had once been Zeda's floating in his wake.
"You need help?"
"Aye. Prince Mover was supposed to be helping me choose what things we might need for the campaign. My arm, you see,"
he said, wincing as he tried to lift one of the bags.
"It grows weaker."
He felt ashamed that he was even out of breath from that speck of effort.
"Sit, my son."
Volker gestured to the wooden chair by the circular hearth. He tapped the silver hawk cloakpin Marsili had given him earlier that moon.
"I am your Gal Mercedes now. That means I must protect you from others, and from yourself."
Marsili was about to protest, but the fight left him, and with a sigh, he slumped onto the chair, rubbing his palms on the armrests and resting his head on the back.
"But damn, when I was 20, I could have sworn I was a lion. Tall, proud, lean, and brimming with energy. When I was 30, I felt sluggish. A little slow, thanks to the lack of daily drills with the army."
He clasped a pouch of loose skin near his waist as he said this.
"At 40, it was as if someone had taken out all my muscles and replaced them with straw. And then there are the aches and pains in the cold season. All those bumps and cuts from my younger days now haunt me when the winter comes. But now, approaching my 44th summer, I feel 100 times worse than that. I've never known frailty like it. The pains in my chest, the weakness of my limbs, the quickness with which I tire, and the ease with which my mind wanders is terrifying."
"And there was an old king on the island of the Sherden who suffered a similar ailment to yours,"
Volker said,
then added swiftly, "not that you are old."
"Not as old as I'll be tomorrow,"
Marsili said, managing a weak chuckle. It still amused him how much Volker's jagged accent had softened and how well he had mastered the Hittite tongue.
"Tell me about him, this king."
Volker crouched by the fire at the king's side. Marsili noticed how his pale blue eyes grew distant, the reflected flames dancing in them.
"He was a kind man, a good ruler. Every day he would invite families to dine with him, high-born farmers, beggars even. He did not keep vaults of silver for himself. Indeed, he saw little value in shiny metals and gems."
"And his illness? Did it kill him?"
Volker shook his head ever so slowly.
"No. A young guard of his did. The old king was too trusting, you see. This young guardsman and a band of co-conspirators dragged him from his bed one night and up onto the keep roof. They slit open his belly, pulled out his gut ropes and tied him there alive, and let crows and vultures descend to tear him apart from the inside. He lived for 2 days like that, tormented."
Marsili recoiled in disgust.
"Why? Had they put a knife through his heart or tossed him from the roof, they could have achieved their end all the same. Why the grim torture?"
"Some said the young guardsman enjoyed it."
Marsili felt glad of the heat from the hearth.
"But why, anyway? The king, as you say, stored no wealth. What had they to gain?"
Volker shrugged.
"The throne. The power to hoard the wealth that the old king chose not to. Respect."
"Respect,"
Marsili said, arching one eyebrow.
"Respect is won by example."
Volker nodded slowly.
"And that was the mistake the usurpers made. For all the Sherden people heard the old king's cries. They knew what had happened. They rejected the young guard."
"Rejected him? Put him to death, surely?"
Marsili laughed dryly. A log snapped and hissed, then settled in the fire.
They put him to an equally cruel torture, Volkas said.
He turned his gaze to Marsili.
Now can you see why I left such a place behind, my son?
Marsili felt an odd chill for a moment, but put it down to the dying fire.
Yes. Yes, I can. A brutal land.
Volkas sighed and smiled sadly, then rose.
Let me carry the bags to the stables and the carriage. You rest here, and I shall bring you a cup of the root brew.
Marsili's mood brightened. The tangy drink was pleasant. Nothing like the vile muck the Asu healer had been trying to ply him with.
Aye, that would be good.
As Volka made to leave, Marsili added,
Tell me, Volka, and I've been itching to ask, why do you insist on wearing that brutish helm at all times?
I have my reasons.
Volka smiled, halting in the doorway.
Very well,
Marsili shrugged.
Every man has his secrets. But the horns, are they not a bane in battle? They merely give your foes something to grab hold of, do they not?
Volka chuckled.
They do, true enough.
Then he smiled, his pale face half obscured in shadow.
But don't they make me look damn terrifying?
Volka made his way to the palace scullery. The place was empty and a picture of cleanliness and organization. A spotless stone floor, ovens, rows of hanging, pristine white aprons, and shelves stacked with pots and cooking implements. He came to a wooden bench lining the walls and selected a cup from the row of gleaming copper vessels resting upside down on a shelf there. He poured priest-anointed water from a vase to fill the cup halfway, then brought a small wooden box from his purse. It was no bigger than his hand. Opening it released a waft of decay. He took a knife from a trough of implements and scooped out just a speck of the green-brown puree within the wooden box. The mixture, sweet clover petals, putrefied with fragments of fungi, was known only to him. He tapped the knife on the edge of the cup so the mixture dropped into the water, then stirred it in. The odor of decay was still strong, so he lifted a small clay pot of honey, popping the wooden lid off and tipping in a copious measure of the thick, sweet nectar. That was why the root brew tasted so good, he smiled. The flavor of decay masked. It reminded him of the venison he had once hung in his stony barn on the Isle of the Sherdon. Some of the nobles had wanted to devour it on the day the deer had been caught, but he had dissuaded them, convinced them to let the meat rest over a period of 2 days. When they had protested, he had convinced them to wait by describing the process of controlled rot to age the meat. Controlled rot, he reaffirmed, a smile tugging at the edges of his mouth.
Ah, Volka,
a voice spoke. Volka swung round to see the king's favoured, weak-chinned Asu approaching. The healer held up a fistful of leeks and a leather bucket of wet red clay.
I have had a thought. The Labana enjoys leeks, aye?
Volka glowered at the Asu.
And the red clay of the Ambar is said to be sacred, healing even. So perhaps if I was to cook him a broth of leeks and clay, it might prove to be enjoyable and beneficial.
Perhaps, Volka said. What next, bread and ox shit?
Well, you don't seem too perturbed by the notion, so I'll give it a try. Thank you.
The Asu turned to leave, but halted, looking back at the cup in Volka's hand.
Oh, is this the famous root brew the king talks of?
Yes. Now, I'd best get it to the...
My, it does look thick indeed.
The Asu's eyes widened, his head craning over the cup.
May I ask what the ingredients are?
Maybe next time I can show you,
Volka said, brushing past the healer. But the Asu caught his arm. He stared down at the fragile man, knowing that his horned helm and a stiff look was enough to ward off most bothersome types. Yet the healer was insistent.
I really ought to find out now. I wouldn't be doing my job if I did not thoroughly test the potion and have the ingredients catalogued by Ruba and his scribes.
Volka laughed.
You are dedicated to your duties, aren't you?
He said, slipping an arm around the Asu's shoulder.
Come, I will show you,
he said, walking the fellow back to the bench. He lifted the wooden box from his purse with one hand, placing it on the top of an upright barrel of wine next to the bench.
This is the key ingredient, he said. Take a look.
The Asu rested his hands on his knees and crouched a little to inspect the box. He reached out to lift it, then opened the lid. His nose wrinkled, and he turned his head towards Volker.
It smells revolt.
Volker shot one hand down to grip the back of the Asu's neck, and with the other batted the lid from the wine barrel. The Asu's strangled cry had barely begun when Volker then plunged the healer's head into the blood-red wine. As the healer thrashed, Volker's arm shuddered to hold him there. Wine bubbled and leapt from the barrel.
It does smell dreadful, doesn't it?
He said, catching the box as it slid away from the barrel lid. The Asu's arms flailed now, his gurgling cries barely audible from deep within the barrel.
And so will you, if and when they find you washed up on the Ambar's banks.
As the healer's body convulsed and gradually weakened, Volker looked up at the scullery ceiling, imagining King Marsili on the floor above.
Aye, controlled rot.
Chapter 11. Under the Shadow of Perua, Spring 1301 BC. The distant pipes of the Festival of the Earth played for 38 days, the skirling song just audible at the Fields of Bronze. Every night Hattu lay in his rough soldier's bed, the barrack dorm empty, imagining the goings-on back at Hattusa. The celebrations would begin with a procession to the north of the city through the Ossuary fields, known as the Meadow of the Fallen, and on to the rock shrine. He imagined the feasting, the strong beer, the song, the games and the laughter. Strangers would share each other's homes and exchange food and gifts. Nobody would be alone. Nobody back in the city, at least. He sighed and rolled over in his bed, now wondering if Arrow had made it back to Hattusa safely, and if Atia had received the bracelet. For a moment he mused jealously at the thought of Muwa giving her something finer. His days were spent helping Kurunta and the small knot of veterans still stationed here to drag equipment to various spots on the training fields, to sweep out oxpires, and to count and distribute weapons around the various armories attached to the many dormitories. On the 39th day, the rain stopped, and so did the tantalizing pipe music. The day after, as he chopped logs for firewood, the distant call of the campaign horn sounded. He stopped in his duties and shielded his eyes to peer to the east. He could see nothing at this distance but rising vapor from the drying rain pools, but he knew what was happening. The army was on its way to Pala and to Mana, King Marsili and Prince Muwa at their head, as always. A momentary ire flared as he thought of father, but it faded fast.
Gods be with them. Let them take back Sarpa's dishonored head, he whispered, imagining his dead brother's wraith marching with them.
A few days later, the sky was cloudless and the sun warm on the skin, and so Hattu began his 14th summer, knee-deep in a pit near the edge of the academy grounds, shoveling spadefuls of ox dung onto a heap at one side. It reminded him of something. About this time a year ago...
Hattu!
A voice said. Hattu swung round to see Dagon standing there, clean and looking the better for a winter at home. Hattu, on the other hand, was smeared in filth. The pair gawped at one another for a moment, a mirror image of their meeting like this the previous year. Then each buckled in two with laughter. As that day and the next few wore on, companies of men trickled in from Hattusa, veteran hundreds who had been left behind by the king. Every so often, some of the mountain wolves would arrive. The last to arrive were Tanku and Garin, who sauntered in when Dagon and Hattu were still working together on the infinite dung pile.
Ah, oh, it's as if we've never been away,
Garin teased. Yet it turned out, as Tanku explained, that the two new arrivals had spent a winter of squalor, living and working at Kurunta's home in Hattusa's lower town, also slipping and sliding in animal filth, whilst the general's favourite pig terrorised them, chasing them and sneaking up behind them before squealing shrilly.
And Karunta's wife was worse,
Garin said, quickly looking over his shoulder to check who was within earshot.
Well, at least Korunta wasn't there for long,
Tanku said.
After 2 nights on the receiving end of his wife's fiery tongue, he upped and left, back here. To torture you, no doubt.
He nodded to Hattu.
Welcome back, Herklus,
Korunta barked, sneaking up behind them.
Sir,
the four replied in panicked unison.
My wife is a walking earache, isn't she?
He said dryly.
Tanku and Garin's faces drained of colour.
If you were listening to us a moment ago, then you must have misheard,
Tanku started.
The rest of the mountain wolves,
Korunta cut Tanku off, embellishing the appellation with a scoff,
are in the barracks. You pair are the last to arrive.
I apologise, sir, it's my fault,
Tanku said.
I'll have them kitted out at the muster area within the hour. Come.
He waved the other three towards the gates of the vast barrack compound. But Korunta held an arm out to bar Tanku's path.
Oh, no. Not for you.
Sir?
This one is to be trained on the chariot.
Korunta stabbed a disdainful finger at Hattu. Tanku, Garin, and Dagon all looked at Hattu. Hattu's mouth moved wordlessly as he tried to find some sort of explanation.
And he needs others to train with him. Kistner will lead the wolves while you're away.
Away?
Dagon said, bemused. A frantic rumble and a crunch of gravel and stone split the air. Hattu and the rest swung round to see an apparition coming for them, ploughing across the dust from the stables like a serpent. The tongue was a thrashing mass of hooves and dancing manes of a pair of yellow dun stallions, laced with strips of bronze and dangling ropes. The head was a wooden bronze-trimmed war chariot, the copper hobnails in the two wheels glittering as they blazed across the dirt. And the fat plume of dust, spiralling up in the contraption's wake, was the serpent's body and long tail. It sped for them, maybe 3 times faster than the quickest sprinter Hattu had ever seen. He saw, just behind the 2 stallions, an ebullient, leathery-skinned driver with wind-tousled brown hair streaked white at the temples, white as his grinning teeth, and a brown forked beard. He was a fair age, but his eyes were wide and gleaming like a boy's at the first sight of lightning, mouth agape in his cajoling of the horses, the whip cracking high over the traces to urge them onwards. For that instant, it seemed certain that the chariot was about to trample straight over the group of 4 and Korunta. Garin screamed in a fashion that would have embarrassed a girl, but with a sharp tug on the reins and a cry, "Ho!" the chariot horses leaned to one side, bending the path of the charge around the 5 in a wide arc. The chariot slowed and settled, having circled them once. The stallions' mouths and necks were laced with sweat and white froth as they panted through the bronze bits in their mouths, and the pungent smell of stable-yard grew suddenly rife. The driver's wild expression settled, but only a little.
"Old horse!"
Korunta enthused, pumping his clenched fist in the air in greeting. Instantly, Hattu recognised the driver, even though he had only seen him a few times in his life. Just as General Nuanza was the army's master archer and Korunta the infantry champion, Coulter was the famed master of chariots. Coulter was a Hurrian by birth, and as with all Hurrians, he was an expert trainer of horses. He had come into the service of the Hittite king many years ago, schooling the army on the construction, repair, and operation of war cars, and raising the herds that would haul them. The charioteer lashed the reins to a small hook on the bronze-lipped rim of the chariot, then leapt down from the open back of the carriage, his bare feet slapping onto the dust. He wore an ornately etched brown leather cuirass with no under-tunic. His legs were like the trunks of an aged tree, knotted and bulging with muscle, like Korunta's upper body. He was not a big man, but all the same, the vehicle slumped forward a little as soon as it was unburdened with his weight. As Korunta and the chariot master embraced, dust puffing up from their garments, Hattu and the others shared suspicious looks.
"Come late summer, the Labana will judge this shower in the chariot ordeal,"
Korunta said, sweeping a finger across Tanku, Dagon, and Garin.
"Should they fail, then they will forever be infantrymen."
Then he pointed at Hattu.
"And should this one fail, then he will fail as a warrior. Leave the fields of bronze and return to his tablets. No prince can serve as a low-ranking foot soldier. It would be a bleak omen."
Hattu's body clenched with fright and fire.
Put them through their paces, old horse,
Kurunta said to Coulter, then swiveled his good eye at the four, particularly Hattu, and grinned.
And tonight, when they've soiled their loincloths or fallen under a horse, send the whimpering curs, or the remains, back to me.
Kurunta turned away, roaring with laughter at his own words, and stomped back towards the infantry barrack compound.
Hilarious, Dagon muttered. I think I might have laughed up my liver.
A warm breeze swept around the four. Hattu beheld the chariot. His heart thundered at the closeness of the vehicle. His stomach melted at the thought of riding one. Later that afternoon, Hattu, Tanku, Dagon, and Garin stood under the hot sun on the chariot fields just north of the academy, with no armor or weapons. The dusty grounds were hemmed by the red fells to the west. On a tall boulder there, the pale stone statue of a prancing mount, an effigy of Perua, the horse god, watched as a group of veteran chariot riders sped across the training area in a blur of bronze, hooves, lashing hair and whips. They operated a good arrow shot away, leaving this edge of the chariot plain free. The Lords of the Bridle, as they were called, counted nearly 400 battle cars in their ranks. Some 300 of the vehicles had been disassembled and packed onto the wagons that had gone northwest to Pala with King Mersili, and another 50 were distributed to the garrison towns and the frontier forts, leaving this handful of 30 or so in reserve. Each chariot bore a team of two men, one with a bow, tipless arrows, and an equally tipless spear, the other grasping reins and whip, the long flowing hair of each snapping in the wind like night-black banners. They sped to and fro, criss-crossing the plain like snakes in some ritual dance. All the time, the armed man on each car turned to face the nearest speeding vehicle, eyes tracking the movements of their foe. One man hurled his spear pole across the void. It was like the lash of a lizard's tongue, striking the driver of another car square in the chest. The driver fell from sight onto the car floor, and the chariot rounded quickly and almost toppled over. A moment later, the coughing, spluttering driver rose with the aid of his warrior, and the pair saluted the opposite chariot crew who had bested them. The victorious two saluted back, then rode off with a whoop and a lash of the whip.
"Warrior and driver," Coulter said of the spectacle. "Like the bee and the flower, each depends upon the other, and one has an almighty sting."
Hattu glanced at the tutor, and noticed that a trio of stable hands had begun fussing around the resting chariot nearby.
"Yet men are but components of the whole. A chariot is not just a fine carriage."
He moved over to trace his hand over the blue-dyed poplar planks and bronze lip that formed the three sides of the chariot.
"Yes, it involves metallurgy, woodworking, tanning, and more."
Then he strode over to stroke the muzzle of one of the two sorrel-red stallions they had led here from the nearby byre that morning.
"Nor is a chariot the horse, nor is it the crew. Neither is a chariot the mere coupling of these things."
He held up one finger.
"A chariot is the result of these things becoming one in mind and body. When driver and warrior think the same thoughts, when the horses speed up even before the crack of the whip, when the carriage's timbers bend under the impact of a hard rock, saving the wheel."
The stable hands beckoned the four over to assist in belting a thick, bronze-studded cloth around the stallions' heads to protect their heads and necks. The beasts began snorting and pawing at the ground, no doubt sensing the training schedule that was to come. Hattu smoothed one beast's mane, and this seemed to calm it. Next, the stable hands lifted two bronze-scale aprons from a storage hut. Hattu took the edge of one and gasped at the weight as they lifted it onto the leftmost stallion's back. Tying the straps, he now felt genuinely sorry for the creature, burdened with such weight in the hot afternoon. But even when the stable hands secured a breast harness around the stallion's necks, still, they did not show any sign of complaint, standing firmly, their thick muscles bunched under their smooth, dark red hides.
"Don't pity the horses. They are arrogant creatures, eager to confound their drivers,"
Coulter said, while the stable hands took to grappling with and patting the horses' tails. Hattu almost laughed at the vain practice, then noticed the horses pulling the chariot sparring nearby, all had their manes and tails neatly groomed likewise. The mesh of reins and gear lashing, tightening and slackening all around them, illustrated the purpose, to stop the creature's hair becoming entangled.
"This is rage,"
Coulter said, patting the muscled shoulders of the leftmost mount, then did the same with the other.
"And this is thunder. A lovely, peace-minded pair,"
he grinned. The horses nickered, as if in reply.
"They came to us from Troy as foals, and enjoyed play and pasture when they were colts. Thought they were in for an easy life," he said with a chuckle. "Then last year, while you were being broken on the Red Hills, this pair were put through 7 months of galloping around the Oval."
He pointed to the foot of the fells, where a well-worn racetrack was marked out with wooden posts.
"They rode alone at first, then with light riders sitting on their croup, and, by Tahunda, they were not easily pleased with those passengers. After that, we slit their nostrils."
He pointed at the dark, healed gashes either side of the beast's noses.
"They near enough kicked one of my grooms across the Red River. But we only did it so they could draw in deeper breaths and maintain longer charges. After that, we taught them to race with empty chariots in tow. Now, what could possibly be next?"
he said, eyeing the four, drumming his fingers on his chin.
For Hattu, the answer was obvious. "Next, you train them to tow chariots with men on board?"
Coulter's eyes lit up, and he shot a finger out at Hattu.
"Wrong! Next, you will train them to tow chariots with men on board,"
he clarified, leaping where he stood, clapping his hands once and laughing. Two stable hands were now securing an oxhorn-shaped willow yoke across the shoulders of the two armoured red stallions, securing it to each beast's breast harness.
"Attention,"
Coulter said to the watching four.
"You will be doing this yourselves after today."
The third hand then lowered the hinged draft pole, attached to the base of the chariot car, so the free end came down across the centre of the yoke, where the other two stable hands clipped it in place with bronze rings. Lastly, they skillfully coaxed the horses to open their mouths with a handful of hay, then inserted a bronze snaffle bar in each duped mouth, and threaded the four reins through the loops at either end of each snaffle, back and through loops on the yoke, and then rested the free ends of the tethers on the bronze rim of the chariot car.
"Your vehicle awaits,"
Coulter beamed. He waited just long enough for each of them to stammer some half-word of doubt and confusion before hopping into the car himself.
"One at a time, with me. You first,"
he summoned Hattu.
"Come on, don't stand there shaking with bravery."
"Oh, we'll share your bread tonight in your memory,"
Dagon whispered after him. Hattu cast him a sour look and nearly stumbled, then gingerly climbed up into the car to stand just left of Coulter. The space was limited, with his and Coulter's hips touching. He detected an odour of horse, sweat, and leather, and couldn't quite work out whether it was coming from the chariot master or the horses. The car only came up to his thigh, giving him the feeling that a sudden push in any direction and he would be pitched out. He righted his feet for balance, and to his surprise, the car floor flexed under his soles. It was made not of solid wood, but of a thick lattice of rawhide strips.
"Better that than broken legs should you hit a rock,"
Coulter said.
"You'll get used to it."
He cleared his throat and shuffled his shoulders, handing Hattu a stiffened leather belt.
"You best put this on to support your sapling back."
Hattu was about to complain, but noticed that wild look returning to Coulter's face as the chariot master raised the whip. So instead, he buckled the wide leather belt on as swiftly as he could with trembling fingers.
"Now,"
Coulter yelled,
"all you have to do is hold on. Yah!"
The scream was enough to convince Hattu to grab the lip of the chariot car in the breath before the whip cracked and the stallions' bodies tensed. The chariot lurched forward, stillness to a violent surge in a heartbeat. Faster, faster and faster. Hattu felt the fears in his belly shoot across his entire being like raindrops blown across a smooth surface. And the still day was banished as the wind of the ride grew into a shrieking whistle, warring with the thunder of hooves and the din of breaking stones under the wheels. The gust battered Hattu's face, casting his hair up in his wake, throwing his brow band off, stinging his eyes. He clung to the car lip with all his strength, as the vehicle bucked and leapt as if determined to cast him out. Very quickly, he understood how Coulter had built up such strong, sinewy legs.
"You see,"
Coulter howled gleefully,
"does not every man long to move fast and free like a horse? This is it! This is it!"
"I,"
Hattu croaked, panic strangling his words.
"Scared? Ha! Then all is well. Courage is like a muscle. It must be worked and strengthened, fueled with fear time and again until the muscle is hard and strong,"
Coulter shouted over the rushing air. Scarcely comprehending, let alone capable of replying, Hattu noticed the chariot master's arms tensing, the rightmost of each horse's two reins tightening and pulling on that side of their mouths. He sensed the violent turn before it happened, and just threw his weight towards Coulter before the horses swung to the right. He felt every sinew of the muscles developed in the red hills groan and ache as the turn went on, around the shaded southern end of the oval, seemingly lasting forever.
"Good! Good!"
Coulter shouted.
"Not many anticipate the turn."
"Not many.
What happens to them?"
Hattu yelled. Coulter said nothing, drawing a shard of burnt gold rock from the pocket of his tunic and tossing it off past Hattu and out of the left side of the chariot. It shattered against a larger boulder with a puff of dust.
"They tend not to make it past the first session. They return to the barracks to serve in the infantry. If they can still walk."
Coulter released the tension in the reins, and the horses straightened up again, now heading back towards Dagon, Tanku, and Garin. Hattu felt the initial wave of terror pass. Now there was a crumb of certainty, just like that which he sought when climbing. A hint of smugness crept into his thoughts, knowing that his turn was almost over. They thundered on, then made another gentler turn to slow and stop where they had started by the oval's northern end. Hattu leapt down from the car, his step shaky, his heart still racing.
"Well, let's get this over with,"
Garin said, stepping forward, his face pale. Coulter laughed, leapt down and held up a hand to bar the lad.
"Not yet."
He pressed a hand onto Thunder's breast and invited the others to do the same. It was beating fiercely, Hattu realized, just like his own.
"Thunder, indeed," Coulter said. "And a good driver never rides his horse to exhaustion. The storm in their hearts must be harnessed and used wisely. A charge can win a battle, but if overused, it can also ensure defeat."
"My father keeps horses on his farm," Tanku interrupted. "The stouter ones are strong but slow. Perhaps a more spry horse might be able to gallop longer."
Coulter grinned.
"Fast at the gallop, but hardy enough to trek to faraway retinue, should the Egyptians invade. No, you need balance," he said,
one wagging finger raised in example. He returned his hand to Thunder's heart, then checked Rage's too.
"It is time,"
he said, bidding Garin forward. For the rest of the day, they took turns to ride with Coulter. At times he made sharp turns and sudden stops, testing the new horses and potential crew in every aspect. Near sundown, he called over a pair of the chariots sparring nearby and had them ride just ahead of Thunder and Rage. On his command, the leading chariots would slow suddenly, allowing him to test the reactions of the four young soldiers and of Thunder and Rage. They were swift to veer around the chariots ahead. Soon, the four were vying to have another turn driving the vehicle. At last light, the chariot field was laced with a mesh of scars from the many twists and turns. Hattu and his three fellow soldiers helped dismantle the chariot, and Coulter watched on, silent, stroking his forked beard in thought.
"What happens now, sir?"
Dagon asked.
"You walk with me back to the stables. Then you return to the barracks."
"And tomorrow?"
Garin asked.
"Well, you've not soiled yourselves or died horribly under the wheels, so you have the makings of a chariot crew in you. Karunta will be disappointed. Come back to the stables at first light."
Hattu gazed up at the staring eyes of the horse god, Perua, an almighty shiver shooting down his spine. Over the next month, Hattu lived for the thrill of the charge. Some days he would waken before the dawn horn, his blood already fired with excitement. These mornings he would glance around the barrack hut to see Tanku, Garin, and Dagon's eyes glinting, awake like him, while all others lay in a deep, exhausted slumber, snoring like boars, and some releasing inhuman quantities of gas. As soon as the morning muster was over, the four would race to the stables, help Coulter and his hands load a wagon with fodder and equipment, then ride to the nearby chariot field. After a month with Coulter, the chariot master chose Hattu and Dagon to ride together as a team. They practiced like this for days on end, taking turns as driver and passenger. Soon, Coulter brought up a second chariot and pair of horses, and took to racing one team against the other. Tanku and Garin rode two silvery steeds against Hattu and Dagon with thunder and rage. Speed and swiftness of thought won Hattu and Dagon 6 of 10 bouts. Hattu learned exactly when to lash his horses and when to slow them, allowing them to flow round the bends and storm along the straights. And when Dagon had the reins, Hattu learned how to apply his weight to add grace and momentum to the ride. Skilled as Hattu was with the reins, it soon became apparent that Dagon was the better driver. The summer became a blur, racing, grooming, learning how to lead the horses across deep water, swimming with them when necessary, and then night riding, using the echo of their hooves and wheels to manoeuvre with only starlight overhead. It was not until the hottest month that Coulter had stable hands bring arms to them. They handed Hattu and Tanku each a leather cuirass and pointed helm, a headless spear, a bow, and a quiver of snub arrows. The pair looked at one another, then at Coulter.
"Drivers,"
he said, pointing to Garin and Dagon.
"Warriors,"
he added, meeting Hattu and then Tanku's eyes.
"Battle is the test of horse, man.